Section 3, Big Business, An American Story. In the 1860s, the oil industry in the United States was highly competitive. One highly efficient company was Standard Oil, owned by John D. Rockefeller and his associates. Because his company shipped so much oil, Rockefeller was able to negotiate rebates or refunds from railroads that wanted his business. This gave his company an advantage, and he began to pressure other oil companies to sell out to him. Oil producer Franklin Tarbell pledged never to surrender. Tarbell's daughter, Ida, later recalled her father's indignation over Rockefeller's maneuvers. "It was as if somebody had tried to crowd me off the road. There were rules. You couldn't use the road unless you obeyed those rules. The railroad, so said my father, ran through the valley by the consent of the people. They had given them a right of way. The road on which I trotted was a right of way. One man had the same right as another, but the railroads had given to one something they could not give to another. The strong wrested from the railroads the privileges of preying upon the weak." Quoted in All in the Day's Work. The Rise of Big Business. Before the Civil War, the personal wealth of a few people operating in partnership financed most businesses, including many early factories. Most manufacturing enterprises were very small. By 1900, everything had changed. Big businesses dominated the economy, operating vast complexes of factories, warehouses, offices, and distribution facilities. Economics. The role of corporations. Big business would not have been possible without the corporation. A corporation is an organization owned by many people, but treated by law as though it were a single person. A corporation can own property, pay taxes, make contracts, and sue and be sued. The people who own the corporation are called stockholders because they own shares of ownership called stock. Issuing stock allows a corporation to raise large amounts of money for big projects while spreading out the financial risk. Before the 1830s, there were few corporations in the United States because entrepreneurs had to convince a state legislature to issue them a charter. Beginning in the 1830s, however, states began passing general incorporation laws, allowing companies to become corporations and issue stock without charters from the legislature. Economies of scale. With the money they raised from the sale of stock, corporations could invest in new technologies, hire a large workforce, and purchase many machines, greatly increasing their efficiency. This enabled them to achieve what is called economies of scale, in which corporations make goods more cheaply because they produce so much so quickly using large manufacturing facilities. All businesses have two kinds of costs: fixed cost and operating or variable costs. Fixed costs are costs a company has to pay whether or not it's operating. For example, a company would have to pay its loans, mortgages, and taxes regardless of whether it was operating. Operating costs are costs that occur when running a company, such as paying wages and shipping charges and buying raw materials and other supplies. The small manufacturing companies had been typical before the Civil War, usually had very low fixed costs but very high operating costs. If sales dropped, it was cheaper to shut down and wait for better economic conditions. By comparison, big companies had very high fixed costs because it took so much money to build and maintain a factory. Compared to their fixed costs, big businesses had low operating costs. Wages and transportation costs were such a small part of a corporation's costs that it made sense to keep operating, even in a recession. In these circumstances, big corporations had several advantages. They could produce goods more cheaply and efficiently. They could continue to operate in poor economic times by cutting prices to increase sales rather than shutting down. Many were also able to negotiate rebates from the railroads, thus lowering their operating costs even further. Small businesses with high operating costs found it difficult to compete against large corporations, and many were forced out of business. At the time, many people criticized corporations for cutting prices and negotiating rebates. They believed the corporations were behaving unethically by using their wealth to drive small companies out of business. In many cases, the changing nature of business organization and the new importance of fixed costs that caused competition to become so severe forced many small companies out of business. Reading check. Describing. What factors led to the rise of big business in the United States? The consolidation of industry. Many corporate leaders did not like the intense competition that had been forced on them. Although falling prices benefited consumers, they cut into profits. To stop prices from falling, many companies organized pools or agreements to maintain prices at a certain level. American courts and legislatures were suspicious of pools because they interfered with competition and property rights. As a result, companies that formed pools had no legal protection and could not enforce their agreements in court. Pools generally did not last long. They broke apart when one member cut prices to steal the market share from another, which then allowed competition to resume. By the 1870s, competition had reduced many industries to a few large and highly efficient corporations. Andrew Carnegie and Steel. The remarkable life of Andrew Carnegie illustrates many of the different factors that led to industrialism and the rise of big business in the United States. He was born in Scotland, the son of a poor hand weaver who emigrated to the United States in 1848. At age 12, Carnegie went to work as a bobbin boy in a textile factory, earning $1.20 per week. After 2 years, he became a messenger in a telegraph office, then served as private secretary to Thomas Scott, a superintendent and later president of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Carnegie's energy impressed Scott, and when Scott was promoted, Carnegie succeeded him as superintendent. As a railroad supervisor, Carnegie knew that he could make a lot of money by investing in companies that served the railroad industry. He bought shares in iron mills and factories that made sleeping cars and locomotives. He also invested in a company that built railroad bridges. By age 30, he was earning $50,000 per year, and he decided to quit his job with the railroad to concentrate on his own business affairs. As part of his business activities, Carnegie frequently traveled to Europe to sell railroad bonds. On one trip, he met the English inventor Sir Henry Bessemer, who had invented a new process for making high-quality steel efficiently and cheaply. After meeting Bessemer, Carnegie decided to concentrate his investments in the steel industry. He opened a steel company in Pittsburgh in 1875 and built the first American steel mills to use the Bessemer process. Carnegie often boasted about how cheaply he could produce steel. 2 pounds of iron stone mined upon Lake Superior and transported 900 miles to Pittsburgh, 1 pound and one half of coal mined and manufactured into coke and transported to Pittsburgh, 1/2 pound of lime mined and transported to Pittsburgh, a small amount of manganese ore mined in Virginia and brought to Pittsburgh, and these 4 pounds of materials manufactured into 1 pound of steel, for which the consumer pays 1 cent. Quoted in The Growth of the American Republic. Vertical and horizontal integration. To increase manufacturing efficiency even further, Carnegie took the next step in building a big business. He did this by beginning the vertical integration of the steel industry. A vertically integrated company owns all of the different businesses on which it depends for its operation. Instead of paying companies for coal, lime, and iron, Carnegie's company bought coal mines, limestone quarries, and iron ore fields. Vertical integration saved companies money while enabling big companies to become even bigger. Successful business leaders like Carnegie also pushed for horizontal integration, or combining many firms engaged in the same type of business into one large corporation. Horizontal integration took place frequently as companies competed. When a company began to lose market share, it would often sell out to competitors to create a larger organization. By 1880, for example, a series of buyouts had enabled Rockefeller Standard Oil to gain control of approximately 90% of the oil refining industry in the United States. When a single company achieves control of an entire market, it becomes a monopoly. Many Americans feared monopolies because they believed that a company with a monopoly could charge whatever it wanted for its products. Others, however, supported monopolies. They believed that monopolies had to keep prices low because raising prices would encourage competitors to reappear and offer the products for a lower price. In some industries, companies had a virtual monopoly in the United States, but were competing on a global scale. Standard Oil, for example, came very close to having a monopoly in the United States, but competition with other oil companies throughout the world forced the Standard Oil Company to keep its prices low. Trusts. By the late 1800s, many Americans had grown suspicious of large corporations and feared the power of monopolies. To preserve competition and prevent horizontal integration, many states made it illegal for one company to own stock in another without specific permission from the state legislature. In 1882, Standard Oil formed the first trust, a new way of merging businesses that did not violate the laws against owning other companies. A trust is a legal concept that allows one person to manage another person's property. The person who manages another person's property is called a trustee. Instead of buying a company outright, which was often illegal, Standard Oil had stockholders give their stocks to a group of Standard Oil trustees. In exchange, the stockholders received shares in the trust, which entitled them to receive a portion of the trust profits. Since the trustees did not own the stock but were merely managing it for someone else, they were not violating the law. This arrangement enabled the trustees to control a group of companies as if they were one large merged company. Holding companies. Beginning in 1889, the state of New Jersey further accelerated the rise of big business with a new general incorporation law. This law allowed corporations chartered in New Jersey to own stock in other businesses without any need for special legislative action. Many companies immediately used the New Jersey law to create a new organization called a holding company. A holding company does not produce anything itself. Instead, it owns the stock of companies that do produce goods. The holding company controls all of the companies it owns, effectively merging them into one large enterprise. By 1904, the United States had 318 holding companies. Together, these giant corporations controlled over 5,300 factories and were worth more than $7 billion. Reading check. Explaining. What techniques did corporations use to consolidate their industries? Selling the product. The vast array of products that American industries churned out led retailers to look for new ways to market and sell goods. N.W. Ayer and Son of Philadelphia, for example, developed bold new formats for advertising. Large display ads with illustrations replaced the small-type line ads that had been standard in newspapers. By 1900, retailers were spending over $90 million a year on advertising, approximately 10 times what they had spent in 1865. Advertising attracted readers to the newest retail business, the department store. In 1877, advertisements billed John Wanamaker's new Philadelphia department store, the Grand Depot, as the largest space in the world devoted to retail selling on a single floor. When Wanamaker's opened, only a handful of department stores existed in the United States. Soon, hundreds sprang up. Department stores changed the idea of shopping by bringing a huge array of different products together in a large, elegant building. They created an atmosphere that made shopping seem glamorous and exciting. Chain stores, a group of similar stores owned by the same company, first appeared in the mid-1800s. In contrast to department stores, which offered many services, chain stores focused on thrift, offering low prices instead of elaborate service and decor. Woolworths, a chain store that opened in 1879, became one of the most successful retail chains in American history. To reach the millions of people who lived in rural areas in the late 1800s, far from chain stores or department stores, retailers began issuing mail-order catalogs. Two of the largest mail-order retailers were Montgomery Ward and Sears Roebuck. Their huge catalogs, widely distributed through the mail, used attractive illustrations and friendly descriptions to advertise thousands of items for sale. Reading check. Identifying. What innovations did retailers introduce in the late 1800s to sell goods to consumers? You're the historian. Investigating Standard Oil. By the 1880s, the Standard Oil Company, under the direction of John D. Rockefeller and his associates, had gained control of more than 90% of the oil refining business in the United States. Did Standard Oil use unfair tactics? The United States Industrial Commission investigated, calling Rockefeller himself to testify. Rockefeller said his success was due to the efficiency of his company. George Rice, an independent refiner from Marietta, Ohio, told the Industrial Commission that Standard Oil's advantage was criminal collusion with the railroads. Was he right? You're the historian. Read the following excerpts from the Industrial Commission hearings of 1899, then complete the questions and activities on the next page. From John D. Rockefeller's testimony. Question. To what advantages or favors or methods of management do you ascribe chiefly the success of the Standard Oil Company? Answer, Rockefeller. I ascribe the success of the Standard to its consistent policy to make the volume of its business large through the merits and cheapness of its products. It has spared no expense in finding, securing, and utilizing the best and cheapest methods of manufacture. It has sought for the best superintendents and workmen and paid the best wages. It has not hesitated to sacrifice old machinery and old plants for new and better ones. It has placed its manufactories at the points where they could supply markets at the least expense. It has not only sought markets for its principal products, but for all possible byproducts, sparing no expense in introducing them to the public. It has not hesitated to invest millions of dollars in methods of cheapening the gathering and distribution of oils by pipelines, special cars, tank steamers, and tank wagons. Question. What are, in your judgment, the chief advantages from industrial combinations? A. Financially to stockholders. B. To the public. Answer. All the advantages which can be derived from a cooperation of person and aggregation of capital, it is too late to argue about advantages of industrial combinations. They are a necessity. And if Americans are to have the privilege of extending their business in all the states of the Union and into foreign countries as well, they are a necessity on a large scale and require the agency of more than one corporation. Their chief advantages are, 1. Command of necessary capital. 2. Extension of limits of business. 3. Increase the number of persons interested in the business. 4. Economy in the business. 5. Improvements and economies which are derived from knowledge of many interested persons of wide experience. 6. Power to give the public improved products at less prices and still make a profit from stockholders. 7. Permanent work and good wages for laborers. From George Rice's testimony. I am a citizen of the United States, producer of petroleum for more than 30 years and a refiner of same for 20 years, but my refinery has been shut down during the past 3 years owing to the powerful and all-prevailing machinations of the Standard Oil Trust in criminal collusion and conspiracy with the railroads to destroy my business of 20 years of patient industry, toil, and money in building up, wholly by and through unlawful freight discriminations. I have been driven from pillar to post, from one railway line to another for 20 years in the absolutely vain endeavor to get equal and just freight rates with the Standard Oil Trust, so as to be able to run my refinery at anything approaching a profit, but which I have been utterly unable to do. I have had to consequently shut down, with my business absolutely ruined and my refinery idle. This has been a very sad, bitter, and ruinous experience for me to endure, but I have endeavored to the best of my circumstances and ability to combat it the utmost I could for many a long waiting year, expecting relief through the honest and proper execution of our laws, which have as yet, however, never come. Outside of rebates or freight discriminations, I had no show with the Standard Oil Trust because of their unlawfully acquired monopoly, by which they could temporarily cut only my customers' prices and below cost, leaving the balance of the town 9/10 uncut. This they can easily do without any appreciable harm to their general trade, and thus effectually wipe out all competition, as fully set forth. Standard Oil prices generally were so high that I could sell my goods 2 to 3 cents a gallon below their prices and make a nice profit. But these savage attacks and cuts upon my customers' goods and their consequent loss plainly showed them their power for evil and the uselessness to contend against such odds, and they would buy no more of my oil.